still supporting Trump today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's been a week of really bad news for President Trump, but many of his supporters don't care. This businessman in Iowa still supports Trump no matter what.
I believe in his heart that he wants to make America great again, and I think that's his whole job description.
But many worry about an increasingly isolated president in the White House.
We should worry about policy that's being made without the best minds being put behind it.
Plus, some activists want to clean up all the plastic trash in the oceans by literally scooping it up from the water. This researcher thinks the focus should really be on land.
And that's where a lot of the hard work is happening. It's far upstream trying to stop this flow of trash to sea.
Those stories coming up today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If there's a tachometer for the news business, we're redlining right about now. More new revelations today about ties between the Trump advisors and Russian officials. Reuters reported that Michael Flynn and others had at least 18 undisclosed contacts with Russians during the last 7 months of the 2016 presidential race. At a press conference today, the president was asked again about collusion between his advisors and Russia.
The entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero.
That Reuters story I mentioned also claimed that Michael Flynn and Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak, also spoke after the election, that they discussed establishing a back channel for communication between Trump and Putin, bypassing the national security apparatus. Paul Pillar spent nearly three decades at the CIA and is now at Georgetown University. I asked him what he made of revelations about a secret back channel.
It's not unprecedented to have this kind of back channel that bypasses the bureaucracy. One thinks of what Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon did, you know, before the opening to China. But today we don't have Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon running our foreign policy. We have a president who, I think, to be fair, is on the opposite end of the spectrum with regard to national security and foreign policy experience and the kind of sophisticated strategic thinking that goes along with it. So I think it would be unfortunate to have that kind of bypassing of the bureaucracy with regard to any kind of opening to or relations with Russia.
Specifically, though, a back channel that cuts the intelligence community out of the loop, is there any precedent for that?
The one I just mentioned in terms of the opening in China, although we should note that even Dr. Kissinger afterwards wrote that he would not advise anyone to follow his operating foreign policy out of the vest pocket model that he did. It's the intelligence community who would have all of the information and analysis that could best help the president, inform him, make his interactions with Putin and the Russians all the better grounded in facts and analysis. And that's the cost you're paying if you bypass all that. You lose it.
Right. And as a former staffer at the CIA, how do you feel about a back channel that bypasses the intelligence community?
You know, the biggest kind of feather that an intelligence officer or agency can have in their cap is to be spending a lot of time with and having their product used by the president. But that's not the main reason we should worry about this. It's we should worry about policy that's being made without the best minds being put behind it.
Okay, so in the interest of helping the president, were the Trump advisors naive to think they could hide these contacts from American intelligence agencies?
Well, I think the experience of so many other of these stories that we've been reading in the press over the last couple of months leads us to believe the answer is yes with regard to the likelihood that this sort of thing would not leak or not come out in an investigation. Usually when something untoward happens because it wasn't foreseen, because it in turn was not the result of a orderly and thorough policy process, it's going to come to light.
What is your impression of the current relationship between the intelligence community and the Trump White House? Like, to what extent has each alienated the other?
There certainly have been a wide variety of relations between the last several presidents and the intelligence community. I mentioned Mr. Nixon. He had a very jaundiced view of the intelligence community, as well as the State Department and much of the rest of the bureaucracy. But I have to say that this particular relationship between Mr. Trump and the community is as bad as I have seen it, and seem to be grounded in the judgment by the community about the fact of Russian interference in our election and the president's efforts to simply deny that. Well, when you have a, a judgment on something that important that the community has considered and that they considered important enough and their judgment well-grounded enough, indeed, to make a public statement to that effect, and then for the president basically to just blow it off. That's the ingredient for a very bad relationship, and I'm not sure how much we're going to recover.
CIA veteran Paul Pillar there. Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov was asked today about the drama surrounding the Trump White House. Here's what he said.
We used to have a joke in the Soviet Union that there was a newspaper named Pravda, which means truth, and there was no news in there. The Russian word for news is Izvestia, and there was the newspaper called Izvestia, and there was no Pravda, no truth, in there. Truly, I get the impression that many U.S. media are working in this vein.
Michelle Burdy knows that joke. She's lived in Russia for more than 30 years and works as a translator, interpreter, and also a columnist for the Moscow Times. So you write a lot about language and words. You remember that joke, right?
I do remember that joke.
Yeah, so no.
Except it's usually not applied to American newspapers.
Yeah, which makes it kind of funny to hear Lavrov turning the tables and, you know, using that joke to describe us.
He's enjoying that.
Is he? How do you know?
I think he's because he has the reputation of being kind of a upfront, say it the way he sees it kind of guy. He joked about he didn't hear that Comey had been fired. It was really a way of saying, oh, come on, you're being idiots. Of course I know what this is. And of course, I'm not going to comment on it.
Michelle, I want to ask you about the words during the presidential campaign, because Vladimir Putin used certain Russian words to describe Trump, like the Russian word for brilliant.
Yes, the Russian word he used to describe him is yarky. And that is a word that simply means very bright, a larger than life figure. It is basically positive, but it isn't that he's brilliant or a genius or anything like that at all.
Talk a bit about how he comes across when translated into Russian. What does that sound like?
Sometimes people have trouble with him. They simply don't know what he's talking about. For example, do you remember when they were discussing the nomination for the Supreme Court?
Right.
And Trump tweeted something or said something like, if they don't go for it right away, we'll have to go nuclear. They translated it as they'll have to use the nuclear option, which sort of sounded like the Republicans, if they couldn't get their way, they would have to drop a nuclear bomb on the Democrats. In other cases, they clean him up. And this is partially because you sort of clean up the leaders, you know, sort of that's what you do. They clean up all the run-on sentences or the sentences that begin and then don't go anywhere at all. So he sounds actually kind of more like Putin than he sounds like Trump.
And then there are Trump's tweets. I mean, how do his tweets come across in Russian? Like a word like sad, exclamation point.
In English, all of those Twitter short forms, sad, beautiful, weak, sound rather childish, at least to my ear. In Russian, it's more like, that's sad. Isn't that unfortunate? They sound more adult and kind of presidential. He sounds much better in Russian than he does in English.
That was Michelle Burdy, language columnist for the Moscow Times. Here in the U.S., many people are angry at President Trump right now. Some are even calling for his impeachment, but many people are not. They still believe in the president and his message, make America great again. The World's Jason Margolis was recently in Iowa and spoke with a man who helped spread the president's signature slogan.
When I asked Dave McNear how he became Trump's merchandising guy in Iowa, he gave me a thoroughly entertaining 22-minute answer. Here's a condensed version.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild story. So
he starts the tale a few years after Maytag left his small city of Newton, Iowa, and took some 4,000 jobs with it.
2010 midterm elections. My friend at that time, the mayor, calls up and says, hey, you know, 60 Minutes is going to be calling you. So I did the interview. And then the program ran. My phone starts blowing up, and everybody's like, oh, my God, do you know you're on 60 Minutes? And I'm like, yeah, I do know.
And
I haven't told anybody. My buddy, the mayor, calls me again, and he goes, hey, you're going to get another 212 call. And I'm like, who's this from? He says, I got Mr. Trump on the other line. I'd like to say hi, and we just wanted to reach out to you. We saw the 60 Minutes piece last night, and we're really taken aback by you know, all the struggles your community's had and wanted to know what we could do to help. And I'm like, and he said, we were thinking probably the best opportunity or best avenue for us to get a business relationship going with you is in the hotels in Chicago. And he says, hey, your buddy Trump's going to be in Iowa if you want to meet him. I'm like, yeah, I'd love to just say thank you, you know. I just stuck my hand in and I said, hey, Mr. Trump, I'd like to thank you for reaching out to me after the 60 Minutes piece. And I told him who I was, and he goes, I remember you. Absolutely, I remember you. And I'm shaking his hand. He's like, hey, hey, everybody, I want you to listen to me just a second here. He goes, this guy told his story in 60 Minutes, really touched my heart. And he goes, I hope we're doing some business together. I said, yeah, we are. And he goes, hey, you know what? And if I ever run for president, I want you to do stuff for us.
And the rest is merchandising history. McNair, who is 56, says Trump helped save his small business twice. For Trump's presidential campaign, McNair made hats, signs, and T-shirts for several Midwestern states.
And they all say, Trump, make America great again. So
let me ask you, to you, as Dave, the American from Newton, Iowa, what does make America great again mean to you?
You know what? It's get back to some of the things that growing up as a kid or my 20s and 30s or whatever, the economy was rolling. When the economy's good, people are happy and they got jobs. And I always remember the Ronald Reagan days of, you know, if you're the toughest kid on the block, people don't pick a fight with you. Strongest country in the world in terms of military and economy and everything else. And so that's what Make America Great Again means to me.
The U.S. still has the world's strongest military and economy, but for Dave McNair, it hasn't felt that way in recent years. When Maytag left town, McNair had to lay off two-thirds of his employees. The pain was felt throughout the community. No surprise, Trump's message caught on big time in Newton. I asked McNair his thoughts on one of Trump's major platforms, erecting more trade barriers and putting the brakes on globalization.
We're always on the short end of the stick. You can't continue to do that and can't continue to lose production jobs. I mean, we lost them here. We lost 3,500 jobs in Newton, Iowa. It is hell to rebuild those kind of jobs.
We spoke a couple weeks ago, and McNair said President Trump was doing a great job and was being unfairly maligned in the press. So I asked what he thought Trump's three signature accomplishments were at that point.
Number one, I'm very, very happy with the Supreme Court nomination. We drew a line in Syria 4 years ago, and we never did a damn thing about it. You know what? They crossed that line again, and he did something about it. He's decisive, and so I'm happy with that. And then the reaching out to world leaders, that's huge. And you know what? I'm all for...
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to understand. We said reach out to world leaders. Every president reaches out to world leaders. So how's he doing?
Who's reached out to as many world leaders?
Obama, Reagan, Bush.
No. In the first 100 days, as many people as he has?
All of them.
Okay, well, maybe they have. But in my opinion, maybe it's not factual, but to me it is. I think.
Yes, I was nitpicking because that's my job. But I was also trying to really understand how McNair thinks Trump is making America great again. We spoke for nearly an hour, and I asked McNair what single thought about President Trump he wanted to leave with listeners.
I think he's got a huge heart. I think he really cares about America. I believe in his heart that he wants to make America great again. And I think that's his whole job description. He's a human guy, man. People take him off for this big ego or this or that. Man, he's a lot more like me and you than any of the politicians that I've ever met.
I think you're the first person who's ever told me that I'm like Trump. So
I called McNair back this week after the firing of James Comey and asked if he still felt as positive about President Trump. McNair said, absolutely. He said Comey is acting like a disgruntled employee and the president was right to fire him. McNair says he feels for what Trump is going through right now.
I've never seen in my lifetime, and I've seen a lot of presidents come and go, I've never seen one treated like this. Everything that he does is under a microscope. There's a negative spin on it. President Trump could cure cancer, and there'd still be people that are mad at him because he's putting doctors out of work.
McNair says he wished people would just give the president a chance. For the World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Just ahead, scandal, corruption, and secret tapes. In Brazil, you're with the World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the World. Scandal, secret tapes, talk of impeachment, no Washington. You can sit down for this one. I'm talking about Brazil, where a corruption scandal appears to have now reached the president there, Michel Temer. There are reports of a tape on which Temer authorizes a bribe. His opponents are demanding his resignation. Reporter Catherine Osborne is in Rio de Janeiro. So, Catherine, tell us more about this new revelation and this tape.
The newspaper O Globo reported that a billionaire director of a meatpacking company secretly recorded President Michel Temer authorizing the payment of what was hush money to the jailed ex-House Speaker Eduardo Cunha. So the businessman, Joesley Bautista, made the recording as part of a plea bargain to actually reduce his own sentence in this huge anti-corruption probe that's ensnaring a lot of top businessmen and politicians here.
Yeah, I know Michel Temer had already been feeling the heat. What's the reaction been across Brazil today?
So this plea bargain actually implicated so many people that over 30 police search warrants have been served this morning. One senator has already been stripped of his office today. And as of midday, Brazil's stock index has dropped 10%. That's because it had been rallying in recent months because Temer promised to reduce Brazil's deficit. He has been governing as a pro-market president and making dramatic but unpopular changes to the economy. The drop in the stock market is predicting that his reforms might not pass now. And this evening, there have been protests called across the country calling for him to step down.
So how much is this just kind of paralyzing Brazil right now?
It's pretty chaotic today. Some possibilities include resignation. He could be impeached. A court could also rule that he's unfit for office, which means that before the next elections are slated in late 2018, we could see either direct or indirect elections for a new president. Overall, there's major public feeling that the dirty laundry that a lot of Brazilians have suspected is coming out into the light. So a lot of Brazilians have wanted Temer gone for months. A recent poll found that he had 4% approval. Practically, it means that the labor reforms and austerity measures that he has been pushing may stall in coming months. So it's definitely a drain the swamp moment in Brazil and one in which it's hard to make predictions about what will happen next.
I mean, the parallels with Donald Trump are almost eerie. His popularity is somewhere in the high 30s, low 40s, and certainly not at 4%. But there is the tape, the talk of obstruction of justice and impeachment. How do Brazilians see the parallels? Or is this news of the tape just too fresh for comparisons?
They see the parallels very clearly. And at least for working class Brazilians, a sort of sense of victory has overcome because folks don't believe that the president had the authority to push through these dramatic measures that he had been pushing through. With very little public debate, he'd been making a lot of changes that would make life more difficult for the average Brazilian. He's an unelected president. He came to power after an impeachment. And so a lot of Brazilians are feeling vindicated right now. A lot of Brazilians share the sense of being overwhelmed at the news that Americans have, but they feel like it's part of a process that is necessary and will indeed eventually clean out the political system.
That's reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro. From Brazil to Colombia now for a story that echoes the experiences of soldiers and their families here in the U.S. There are many veterans in Colombia with lasting traumas, both psychological and physical. Take victims of landmines. They often have to live with lifelong injuries to their genitals. My BBC colleague Natalia Guerrero has made a documentary in which she speaks with soldiers in Colombia about this kind of injury. It's called The Silent Wound. And a warning, what you're about to hear includes some references and descriptions that may not be appropriate for younger listeners. One of the soldiers in the film describes the life-changing injuries he suffered when he stepped on a landmine in 2015.
They amputated my leg. I lost these fingers. The others are useless. And the thing with my penis, that affected me deeply. I thought of many things, that I wouldn't have any children.
Natalia, how common are these kinds of injuries in Colombia?
The first thing I can say is that there are not statistics or figures for sure. But the urologist at the military hospital in Bogota, he is pretty sure that 20% of injured soldiers has genital or urinary trauma. So it can be as terrible as an amputation, a total loss of penis, or a testicle, or some irreversible injuries, or different kind of problems related to genitalia.
I suppose it's difficult for their immediate families to hide these injuries from them. Do they talk about their injuries with their families?
Yes, this intimate and private injury is very difficult to discuss between the patient and the doctor at the rehabilitation center, but there are a lot of taboo to talk about sex and intimacy in Colombia still. And the families don't receive psychological support. For example, the wife or the woman or the partners, they don't discuss sex with therapists. They don't have this level of conversation. So it's difficult.
With these veterans who are injured, I would guess it's not just physical trauma. There's got to be psychological trauma, especially when they're confronted with the possibility of not being able to reproduce. How do they reconcile that fact?
Colombia is a macho society. Men are strong, important. The man is important, and is the family is very, very important. Having children, that kind of society we are. And to lose some part of the masculinity, the manhood, it has terrible consequences on this identity.
Was there one veteran whose story you especially remember?
One of them had a urinary trauma. He lost one leg, two arms, one eye, but he's still trying to become a professional athlete, and he's biking now. And he's biking with one leg. His attitude, the way they face sexuality, that's amazing. I was very impressive by them. In general, all the men I spoke with in the different stages of rehabilitation, they are really resilient. And I admire that very much, because when you see them, it's terrible what happened to them, what happened to us as Colombians.
My BBC colleague Natalia Guerrero, who produced a documentary in Colombia called The Silent Wound. Natalia, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
I'm Marco Werman. Here's some friendly advice for foreign leaders visiting the U.S. with their own security guards in tow.
You can't come into the United States and act like authoritarian thugs.
But that didn't stop the Turkish president's security detail from clashing with protesters in Washington. The diplomatic fallout, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You've probably seen the video by now, men in dark suits charging at protesters, pushing them to the ground, and then kicking them repeatedly, even in the head. It happened outside the Turkish ambassador's residence in Washington earlier this week. Opponents of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was visiting with Trump, gathered to protest, and it would appear some of Erdogan's security detail went after them. Now some in Congress are calling for the U.S. Attorney General to file criminal charges against the guards. Whether these Turkish officials are prosecuted will likely come down to one thing: diplomatic immunity. Nicholas Burns of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government explains.
It's an international convention that when a diplomat is stationed in another country, he or she is not subject to criminal prosecution. If he or she breaks a law, they're usually removed from the country, but they're not liable to prosecution. That protects all of us. It protects our diplomats overseas, particularly in authoritarian countries where the charges can be trumped up.
Do you believe diplomatic immunity would apply in this case?
It might not, because these were not, as far as we know, and you've seen the video, I have too, these were members of President Erdogan's security detail, ostensibly mostly people who came with him from Ankara. When a foreign leader visits Washington or any other part of the United States, they are subject to American law and to the protection of our police and security forces. They don't have a right, the security guards of a foreign leader like President Erdogan, to wade into a demonstration and to start beating protesters. That is fundamentally a breach of international law and of common sense, and we cannot allow that to happen in our territory. We can't allow American citizens to have their freedom of speech rights abridged by a foreign power who is an authoritarian power in this case as well. So the State Department announced that they were concerned. I thought that was a weak statement. This is really an outrage, and we should be condemning it. The State Department should condemn it in much stronger terms.
Yeah, what language would you use, and is there anything the U.S. can do to prevent this from happening in the future?
Well, I think in a situation like this, the most effective thing that our government can do is to have a frank, no-holds-barred private discussion at the top of the Turkish government with the chief of staff to the Turkish president, with the foreign minister, and to say, this can never happen again. You can't do this. You can't come into the United States and act like authoritarian thugs and prevent American citizens of doing what our Constitution gives us the right to do, which is to protest. And to have that and to say that there'll be consequences if it happens again. I think you've got to do that privately, but you've also got to stand up for American values publicly, I think in a stronger way than the State Department did this week.
I don't know if it's legally possible or not, but is there the political will to prosecute this case or take some future action?
If these Turkish officials were had diplomatic immunity, it would be extraordinarily difficult to prosecute them, but we could ask them to leave the country. If, for instance, some of these people were employees of the Turkish embassy in Washington, long-term employees, if they were visiting with the Turkish president, probably not. It would be difficult to subject them to prosecution, but not impossible, and it may be that that's what the Justice Department, the State Department, and the District of Columbia authorities are looking at this week.
Has there been any reaction that you know of from Turkey to kind of the rancor here in the U.S. to what happened?
They don't seem to learn the lesson. This has happened before in the United States. It's happened in Europe. It's part of the way that this particular Turkish president and government works. It's disturbing. And, you know, the United States, of course, wants to maintain a good relationship with Turkey because they're an extraordinarily important country. They're a member of NATO. They're the key, probably, to what happens in Syria. So I understand that the administration doesn't want to embarrass the Turkish government, but I think the first responsibility of any government, our government, is to defend our own citizens. And the rights of our citizens were abridged this week.
Nicholas Burns there. He teaches diplomacy and international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. To see the video of that clash with protesters, go to PRI.org. When the Turkish president and Trump met this week, the war in Syria was high on the list of things they discussed. After all, it's one of the toughest challenges both leaders face. Just today, the U.S. struck pro-Syrian government forces inside the country. These types of attacks are exactly what Kinda Haddad keeps an eye out for. Haddad works for a small nonprofit group called Air Wars. She's part of a small team that scours the web every day. She's in London, looking for videos and photos that document coalition attacks inside Syria and Iraq.
So every morning I drop the kids at school, and then I've got a list of about 20 sites that I look at daily. Then I go back to the last 24 hours and go through each post, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whatever. And then I'll identify any allegations against the coalition or Russia or any of the other international actors in Syria. And then once we've identified an incident, then we can research it in depth and try and find more details.
So you're sitting in front of a computer basically all day long. Are you basically looking at bodies and counting them?
Yes, I mean, I am. I'm sitting in front of the computer the whole day basically and looking through all the news sites and media activists. And there is so many sources of information, so many different sources of information. And yes, I mean, we basically have a big, big, massive mammoth document with millions of words, and we separate each incident or each allegation has its own section. And then anything we find about that incident, we put it in that section. And then we can count, once we finish the research, we can count how many are dead and how many are injured.
How much are you doing this for posterity, and how much do you have actual subscribers or people like interested in knowing about the death toll?
We do have quite a few. I'm not exactly sure how many, but I think something like 700 or 800 subscribers. But it's very specialist. Mm. Most of them are military experts and media, basically. In fact, apparently CENTCOM is one of our biggest users.
What is your working relationship like with the U.S. military on this? I mean, what is their relationship with you like?
I mean, it's fairly cooperative. I personally don't communicate with them. Our director, Chris Woods, he has a direct relationship with them. And for example, you know, if we have an incident that is very poorly reported and we're not sure, because CENTCOM publishes daily press releases telling us where they've bombed. So we can cross match with the incidents and the allegations we have. But so if we have an allegation of an incident and the CENTCOM press release doesn't say that they've bombed in the area, then Chris will go to them and will say, look, we've got this allegation and these are the details. Can you tell us, did you, you know, were you operating in this area? And they seem fairly cooperative. I mean, they've become over the years, at the beginning, I don't think it was that cooperative, but they seem to be willing to take the allegations seriously, and they are using a lot of our information, and we can sort of cross-reference with them.
If there wasn't that kind of cooperation, would it be really hard to distinguish between American airstrikes, Russian airstrikes, and Syria's own government airstrikes?
It depends which locations. Mm. So, for example, at the moment in Raqqa, it is mostly coalition airstrikes because the Russians aren't really operating there. Although, having said that, the last couple of weeks, there has been a few incidents with the Russians. But Raqqa, you can be fairly certain that it is the coalition. But in the opposition-held areas, in Idlib province, for example, it's very hard to distinguish between the Russian and the regime because they work together. And sometimes there's been Americans' strikes, unilateral strikes, targeting opposition figures from, you know, what used to be Al-Qaeda in those areas. But somehow people on the ground seem to know that it is the U.S. this time, not Russia or the Syrians. And quite often the U.S. then tells you that they have carried out a strike in the province. So it sometimes gets very, very complicated. Other times it's clearer.
I'm really curious. You drop your kid off in the morning at school, you come back home and you spend all this time in front of a computer looking at various pictures of dead bodies. What kind of toll has this taken on you?
Yes, it's not great, I suppose. I mean, it's not every single, you know, like today, for example, I didn't add a single allegation. And quite often these allegations don't always come with photographs. So it's just, you know, it's names. And even the names can be pretty hard to take because, you know, they're children. They tell you if they're children or they're women. And I mean, yes, I have to say it's not great. But having said that, I suppose I am in a much, much, much better position than all these people that are actually being killed. So I can't feel too sorry for myself.
That was Kinda Haddad, who works with Air Wars, a nonprofit group that documents civilian deaths in Syria and Iraq. On yesterday's show, we spoke with Boyan Slat, a 23-year-old from the Netherlands who came up with an idea to clean up the tons of garbage floating in the world's oceans, specifically the waste that's become concentrated in a giant plastic garbage patch in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Slat's idea is to deploy a system of floating U-shaped booms and screens that concentrate the plastic for collection.
When we have deployed all systems in this Great Pacific Garbage Patch, we expect to be able to clean up 50% of the patch in 5 years' time. We are very confident that the oceans can be, you know, without plastic again within the first half of this century.
It is an ambitious goal, and his company, Ocean Cleanup, has raised some $31 million to make it happen. But not everyone shares Boyan Slat's optimism. Marcus Erickson is with the Five Gyres Institute in California. He says the ocean's good at pushing the trash out.
The ocean is pretty dynamic in pushing it onto beaches or sinking it. So being out to sea in the middle of the ocean trying to collect the trash that's there, I think it's the wrong place to look.
Boyan Slat agrees that production of plastic has to be addressed, but what about cleaning up the end waste? I mean, how do we deal with that? It's been huge in the news this past week.
Sure. There's a lot of trash washing ashore. There was one story just recently, just a couple of days ago in Tasmania, you know, a lot of beach trash washing ashore there. And that's evidence, once again, the ocean is pushing out to shore. I mean, doing beach cleanups is one way to deal with the trash that's already out there. Another way is to support the Fishing for Litter campaigns, incentivizing fishermen who are already out there to pick up trash they see. But the biggest bang for your buck is to follow the sort of the environmental movement happening on this issue. You've got over almost 1,000 NGOs worldwide have come together working on upstream prevention. And that's where kind of all the conversation is now between industry and NGOs working on this, trying to stop the flow from land to sea.
It kind of sounds like you see Boyan Slat as an idealist, but not really road tested to solve this problem. He seems to think that a simple solution is the way to deal with this. You don't see it as that simple?
Well, I don't think it's simple at all. I mean, the complexities in many issues is prevention, trying to see the systems that create the problem in the first place. And that's where a lot of the hard work is happening. It's far upstream trying to stop this flow of trash to sea. If you pick up what's out there, you're not stopping, you know, the problem continuing far into the future. You got to stop the source. I'd say maybe 10 years ago when the idea of garbage patches came into the public sphere, that's when people began to think about, okay, let's go out there and go get it. But this, if you look at the current modeling, where the ocean currents take trash, if you're going to go in the ocean try and get trash, the biggest bang for your buck is to be close to shore or at river mouths. And that's what most cities are doing. You can see a lot of cities are putting booms in their rivers to capture trash. That's the furthest downstream is really sensible to go.
So your book, Junkraft, its subtitle is The Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. It's a great title. What exactly is this rising tide of activism, all these NGOs? What are they actually doing?
So what they're doing, they're coming together and working on upstream mitigations. I can tell you in Southeast Asia, there's a big push to create these localized material recovery facilities where we're getting really good at sourcing where the trash is coming from and dividing it into recyclables and compostables. And the residuals left over, finding a way to deal with those and redesign those products and packaging. And that's the hard work. That's where the rubber meets the road, to work really hard to stop that flow. And it's happening. And that's where, for example, the Break Free from Plastic movement has just coalesced in the last year. It's over 800 nonprofits worldwide with one vision statement. And that's where the focus is. I'm sorry to say, but I think these downstream mitigations in the middle of the ocean is a distraction from the work that almost all environmental NGOs are focused on. You know, interesting, when I'm on these gyre expeditions crossing these garbage patches, what you mostly find out there, and what I think Boyan's mostly going to capture, is fishing gear, big buoys and fishing nets. And, you know, I wish him success to capture trash, but I would like to see him focus upstream where we're seeing lots of the packaging, the small single-use throwaway packaging, styrofoam and thin films and plastic bags that leave our coastlines that don't make it to the gyres. They fragmented this plastic smog long before it gets to where he plans to put his nets.
What advice do you have for our listeners who may be thinking, well, I recycle all my plastic. I'm good to go. It's being dealt with responsibly. Are we also in this country, we've got to be guilty in some way?
You know, I think if you look really close at recycling in the United States, the EPA reports of the plastic we make in 2013, only 9.2% got recycled. And if you look at the economics of recycling, it's not really panning out. So it's less about recycling and more about reduction and supporting smarter packaging and products. I would tell listeners, you know, look at your shopping cart. When you go grocery shopping, you're not buying just the product. You're buying the packaging as well. And think of the entire life cycle. Recycling doesn't cut it 100%. I think reducing the single-use throwaway stuff we get with plastic is going to go a long way to saving our seas.
Marcus Erickson of the Five Gyres Institute. His new book is called Junkraft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And who are the top polluters when it comes to plastic in the sea? The world's Patrick Wynn can tell you. Check out his two-minute video over at PRI.org. Protests, many of them violent, seem to be the norm now in Venezuela. Demonstrators want to oust President Nicolas Maduro. Recent clashes between riot police and anti-government protesters have left more than 30 people dead and more than 400 injured. And that's why a growing number of Venezuelans are volunteering their first aid skills. From Caracas, Mariana Zuniga has our story.
It's not even 6 a.m., but Federica Davila is already up. She's a fourth-year medical student at the Central University of Venezuela. And for the past month, she has been part of the biggest wave of protests here since 2014. But Davila is not marching with a sign. She's working with a group of about 60 other medical students to keep Venezuelans safe during the protests. Their group is known as Primeros Auxilios UCV. The medical volunteers got together after a protest in 2014.
So this started growing, and this year when the protests started, we thought people would need the help, medical assistance, medical aid, and we decided to reactivate it. I think it's the best way that I can help my country at this time.
The latest protest started in March, after the pro-government Supreme Court tried to shut down the opposition-controlled Congress. Even though the court ultimately backed down, the protests have continued. they've become a way for people to vent their anger over what's happened to their country. Venezuelans are living through one of the worst economic collapses ever in Latin America, with severe shortages of food and medicine. The Venezuelan Federation of Pharmacies says the country lacks 80% of the medical supplies it needs.
My family is always worried when I'm on the streets. We don't find medicine or food. It's very hard to find it. We have to do a lot of rows so we can buy food.
It's so hard that the first day that Primeros Auxilios UCV went out to provide first aid in March, they didn't even have basic supplies.
The beginning was very hard because we didn't have, not even gauze, like we don't have cotton, we don't have alcohol. But people started spreading the word that we existed, and we have received a lot of international help from Venezuelans who live in other countries.
Today, chanting protesters are marching in eastern Caracas. Suddenly, there's a sustained ovation for the first aid volunteers. People yell things like, courageous, or God bless you guys.
The feeling that they give us is so big that it gives you the motivation you need to get up and start working again. And you haven't eaten and you haven't slept more than 3-4 hours per day. But it is a feeling that makes you feel like you can do a difference.
But it's risky work. The medical students have to deal with government forces and tear gas, which people here call bombs.
Because in the protests, many people get hurt because of the bombs. A lot of people get suffocated and dehydrated, and they need medical assistance. And because they have wounds, most of them on the head because of the bombs, a lot of things we have to refer to hospitals because it's not something that you can treat on the street.
And sometimes they can't help at all.
The guards started persecuting people, and one guy, he was like 60 or something, he started running, and when he arrived, he had a heart attack, and when I got there to help, he was already gone. I could do nothing for him. It was very hard for me to get over that.
Beyond the extreme shortage of medicine, there's another scarcity. Since 2003, around 16,000 Venezuelan doctors have left the country. Davila says she might eventually have to go to continue her medical education. But for now, she and her friends want to stay and help.
I always wanted to stay here. I mean, that's my goal. And I'm hoping I can achieve that goal.
For The World, Mariana Zúñiga, Caracas.
I love going to the movies. I also love not going and just staying home and streaming films off the net. This dilemma is what everyone is talking about at this year's Cannes Film Festival. For the first time, two Netflix films are eligible for the festival's top prize, the Palme d'Or. Cinema purists, not to mention film distributors and theater owners, are furious. So Cannes bowed to the pressure and changed the rules. Next year, a movie can only compete at Cannes if it's had a theatrical release in France first. But there's a big catch. As a filmmaker, you'll have to wait 36 months before putting it up online, and Netflix will not agree to that. Earlier this week at the festival, the legendary director Pedro Almodovar came down on the side of tradition. Almodovar is saying that the first time you see a movie, it should be on a big screen. The size of the screen, he said, should not be smaller than the chair you're sitting on. You should feel small and humble in front of the image. Then actor Will Smith weighed in. He's on the Cannes jury with Almodovar.
I have a 16-year-old and I have an 18-year-old and a 24-year-old at home. And in my house, Netflix has been nothing but an absolute benefit because they get to watch films that they never even would have seen. There's movies that aren't on a screen within 8,000 miles of them.
Brian Libro is on the phone with me now. He moved to L.A. a decade ago to pursue a career in screenwriting. Brian, who do you agree with here, Almodovar or Will Smith?
Well, I can kind of see both sides of it. I think for folks like Almodovar, especially those who came up working with their hands and using celluloid, he's really speaking in defense of his medium as an artist. There is, I would say agreeably, a kind of different emotional experience seeing a film in a darkened, hushed theater with an audience as opposed to seeing one at home. But I think that what Will Smith is speaking to specifically is the film industry's need to remain flexible with changing technologies as it affects consumption methods.
This Netflix versus traditional movie debate has been playing out for a while, and I think of young directors, often people of color, who can't seem to get traction in Hollywood, but for whom getting movies made for Netflix or Amazon or Hulu is an alternate path. Won't they be especially affected?
Yes, I should say so. And for that matter, you know, a younger artist who's, whether they make a sale of a script or independently produce their own film and Netflix opts either to produce it in-house or simply be a distributor, simply because Netflix outbids the market and purchases their film doesn't necessarily mean that they shouldn't also be eligible for artistic awards.
So I can see you kind of like sitting on the fence, but doesn't this feel like an old school reaction from Khan to the whole debate? And maybe Khan is not keeping up with the times.
I think to a degree, Khan really sees itself as sort of one of those last bastions of cinema purity, I guess you could say. There's something noble, I think, in that pursuit, but it does feel like they may come down on the wrong side of history here.
Screenwriter Brian Liebro, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.